Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. A story from American history that probably gets mythologized more than any other story, definitely shows up in elementary and middle school history books, is the story of the Wright brothers. Here you have two brothers who never left home. They were high school dropouts. They made a living as bicycle mechanics, but somehow they figured out the secret of manned flight at a time when the top physicists around the world were trying to crack the same code. Now, the Wright brothers have been treated in a lot of popular books as basically one organism. They were both equally responsible for sorting out the technical problems of flight. They were equally responsible for working out the complex physics. And when you read a history book about them, they're basically treated as the same person. There's very little to distinguish the two from one another. But according to a new book, that's not exactly the case. Today I'm speaking with William Hazelgrove, who's the author of the book Wright Brothers, Wrong Story: How Wilbur Wright Solved the Problem of Manned Flight. William argues that it was Wilbur who designed the first successful airplane, not Orville. Why Orville was important, and he was there at Kitty Hawk, he generally followed his brother's lead and assisted with the mechanical details to make Wilbur's vision a reality. So William looked through all sorts of archives and family letters and saw that William, when he had a problem with physics, didn't consult Orville, but consulted others. And if we think of Orville as a scribe, William was the poet, the one with the actual vision to make it happen. So in this discussion, we get into all the reasons why history has said that the two of these brothers were equally responsible, how Orville commissioned an autobiography that made the two of them co-equals. So anyway, we get into a discussion of early flight, technology in the early 20th century, and trying to humanize two people that have been spoken of in such legendary accounts. They're more mythological figures than people most of the time. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with William Hazelgrove. William, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
First of all, before we get into your revisionist take on the Wright brothers, what prompted you to want to return to this story and present your take on it?
Well, actually, you know, as a kid, I'm from Virginia, and we used to go to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, for our vacation, believe it or not. We had a cottage there, and I went to that memorial more times than I can count with my parents. And, you know, as a kid, I was like, okay, the Wright brothers and all that. Well, then I read David McCullough's book, and, you know, again, he's a great historian, really admire him and everything. But I, after I finished his book, I wanted more, and I felt like I knew the Wright story already. And there's this sort of this Wright myth, the Wright brothers myth. And I was like, you know, who are these guys? Who are they really? Because, you know, they're sort of these sawdust characters, these sort of figures in history with their derbies and their high collars and, you know, the story. They just went down there, these two guys who were bike mechanics. And you know, built the plane, it flew, and that's the end of the story. But we've never really gotten to know the ins and outs of who the Wright brothers are. And so that really sent me along wanting to, you know, create a book that really told the real story of the Wright brothers. And, you know, because I sniffed that there was something else there. And there was. And that's really, McCullough's book was sort of a springboard for me.
Yeah, and before we reconstruct, I'd like to deconstruct. So could you tell me, what is this common myth that you always hear that McCullough parrots about the Wright brothers that you try to dismantle?
Okay, sure. Actually, it started with Fred Kelly.
Okay.
Fred Kelly was a biographer who, here's what happened. In 1912, Wilbur Wright died. Okay. So this left a vacuum because his brother, Orville, would live until 1948. And so there's this big, long gap in history. But Orville was very reluctant to write any kind of biography or authorize any kind of biography of the Wright brothers. There was a guy named Fred Kelly. Now, Fred Kelly was a very good friend of Orville's. And, you know, guys like Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh and other people, were on Orville saying, you know, you've got to do this. You know, you've got to have this biography. And so finally he said to Fred Kelly, I'll tell you what, you can write the book, but I'm going to approve every single page. And many times Orville wanted to stop it. You know, he would call up Kelly and go, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. And Kelly would talk him back into it. So when this book finally came out, and by the way, the name of it was The Wright Brothers, A Biography Authorized by Orville Wright, When this book finally came out, it became the Bible of the Wright brothers. But in fact, this book was Orville's take on what happened. And it was more Orville's story. And, you know, we'll get into the whole, you know, division of you know, talent. But, you know, when you read this thing, literally, I think Wilbur's name appears 267 times. Orville's name appears 400 in it. So you know, there's this skewed Bible that every historian since has used as a jumping off point, and all the way through McCullough. And what this basically says is it's a sort of a boilerplate story. Two brothers, they became fascinated with flight when their dad brought home a little helicopter that, you know, flew up to the ceiling. And they were sort of inventors. They both dropped out of high school. Neither brother ever moved out of the home. Neither brother ever married. You know, they build a printing press. They have a bike shop. They make their own bikes. They're bike mechanics. They both become interested in flight. They both build a glider, and they go down to Kitty Hawk four times. And by 1903, they crack the code of flight. And the first 12 seconds of flight occurs on December 17th, 1903, with Orville at the, you know, in the pilot seat. And that is what's been handed down, with the famous photo at the end taken by John Tate on December 17, 1903. So that's the boilerplate of the Wright story, and it has not really deviated.
And one other thing, too, with this authorized biography and the David McCullough story, in the authorized biography, does Orville treat he and Wilbur as basically this symbiotic creature, this Vulcan mind meld, where, yes, it's two people, but for all intents and purposes, they're treated as one organism? Does he tell the story like that?
Exactly. And this goes all the way back to their father, Milton Wright. Milton Wright was a bishop, and he believed the word was inherently evil. So he told his two sons and his daughter, Catherine, look, don't go out in the world. The only thing you can trust is the family, and we have to present a united front. So nobody could ever step out and say, I'm different. And so Orville, you know, this was the mantra when Wilbur was alive, so this sort of sealed up the right story. But when Orville went to, you know, have this biography written, yes, it was, you know, they walked the same, they talked the same, they were equal partners in the development of the airplane, except actually, if you read it, it makes it sound more like Orville had more to do with it than Wilbur did. You know, there's key scenes where Kelly puts him, and let's face it, Orville's the guy paying Kelly, and he's approving every single page. So if Orville doesn't like something, it's not going to fly. So this was never, you know, intended in Orville's mind to be this sort of, you know, tell the real story. This was intended to be a, look, we were equal, period. And that's what's presented to the world.
Yeah, and that's a good 101 class to our listeners about historiography, to always cross-examine your sources and question where this is coming from and what are the agendas of people producing sources. And before we get into the invention of flight and the role that Wilbur and Orville each individually played, could you describe a little bit about this world of the 1890s, the 1900s, in which they're in trying to invent an aircraft? Because a lot of us, I think, assume that, oh, all scientists agree that human flight was impossible, and anyone who was trying it was this black and white footage of people in flying suits and bird or bat suits,
right,
with that blooper music playing in the background and these crackpots trying to do stuff. So what is this world in the 1890s, 1900s, when they're trying to invent an airplane?
Well, you're partially right. You know, flying to a lot of people was sort of like going to the moon. So it did, you know, it did bring in a lot of crackpots, and that's those crazy films we see of, you know, the things, the cars with wings and people running off cliffs and everything else. Now, saying that, Samuel Langley, who was the secretary of the Smithsonian, okay, he was the man who was trying to crack flight. So he goes down with Alexander Graham Bell one day in 1896 to a boat called the Ark. And he shoots off this boat a model, a steam-powered model that he had built, okay, under the auspices of the Smithsonian. So this was scientific, right? Well, the first model goes off this boat in the Potomac while, you know, Alexander Graham Bell and everybody's watching the thing, just goes down into the water. So Langley's horrified. He has one more. They launch the second one. It goes down below the deck of the boat. They don't see it, and you know, Langley thinks, oh, my God, the thing went back down into the water. All of a sudden, it rises up and flies around the boat in this big, long arc. Looks like a big steam bug, right, just sort of going around. Well, it lands in the water, and everybody's like, Langley cracked the code of flight, okay, in 1896. All he has to do is build a bigger model. Well, the government comes in and says, you know, we could probably use these for war. Here's $50,000 they give the Smithsonian to develop the bigger model. So Langley is the man. He is the anointed guy, the secretary of the Smithsonian, who's going to crack flight. Right? So everything's on him. Now, you have this guy, Wilbur Wright, and we'll talk about, you know, his role quickly, but soon, but who's down in Kitty Hawk. Nobody knows who this guy is. He's a bike mechanic, and yet he too is going after this Rubik's cube of flight to try and crack it. And there's guys like Lilienthal, who was a German who would put on wings on his back and run off cliffs in Germany. And Lilienthal actually was known as the flying man. And Lilienthal would fly around kicking his feet one way or that way to navigate. Okay, but here's the thing. Nobody understands the physics of flight. We can talk about it in a minute. They don't understand lift coefficients. Lilienthal doesn't understand stall either, or even wind shear, which he encountered. So one day Lilienthal goes off his cliff, and then he goes straight down, breaks his neck, and dies. But in fact, he was the cutting edge at that time of flight. Meanwhile, Langley's trying to build his plane, and the Wright brothers, or Wilbur, is just beginning to, you know, get the bug of flying.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because it almost seems like there's a mini space race happening on who can achieve flight. And the flying man you described sounds silly, but really a lot of them are using the same principle where they look at the physics of a bird and think, how do we apply this to a machine, since a bird is obviously heavier than air? And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't one of the Wright brothers, when Langley died, really stick up for him and say he wasn't foolhardy for his machine because scientific progress happens through rigorous trial and error? Do I have that correct?
Yeah, and actually it's probably a good time to segue off of that and go into how Wilbur got into this.
Right,
okay,
right.
Wilbur's 17, he's playing hockey down the street, a guy named Cruikshank. And Cruikshank is like the neighborhood bully. He's high on, believe it or not, cocaine drops because he's got bad teeth. Turns out later he's a drug user. And here's the bishop's boy, who's kind of Wilbur's headed for Yale, of all places, okay? He's on a totally different path. Oliver Cruikshank raises up his stick and smashes Wilbur's jaw, just decimates it. Wilbur, you know, is severely hurt. He goes into his house, and he has all these complications from it. At the same time, his mother's dying. He goes into a 3-year depression. During this depression, he begins to read books on flight. Also during this time, Lilienthal died, and this really affected Wilbur because he had followed Lilienthal. Wilbur is a fish out of water. He's actually like a writer and artist. He doesn't really like the bike shop. It doesn't really engage him, and this is all in the book. He's sort of a man who has a greater vision, and he has a fantastic brain. You know, he's intellectually, you know, in terms of engineering, he has a great ability. But it hasn't been challenged yet. So at the end of this 3-year journey into the dark night of the soul where his mother dies, and he literally doesn't come out of the house, he reads and reads and reads, and at the end of that, he writes to the Smithsonian, okay, and says, do you have any pamphlets? Do you have any pamphlets on flying? They send him back the latest pamphlets on flying. And then he contacts Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, or rather the Weather Bureau, and says, you know, do you know of any place that has constant wind? And they send him back a bunch of places, and one of them is Kitty Hawk. Now, he takes the known data of the time and builds Wilbur, at this point, because it's just Wilbur. Wilbur builds a kite, sort of a flying wing, all right, But he also comes up with a concept that after twisting the ends of a tube, an inner tube box from a tire, he twists it, and he comes up with a concept from, as you said, watching birds, okay? Because a lot of the books he read were, you know, on animal flight. He comes up with the concept of wing warping, which today we call ailerons. And so he deduces that that's how birds turn, that they actually warp the ends of their wing. And he kind of plays around with this box. So he flies his kite in Dayton by himself, okay? He goes out there to a field outside of Dayton, flies his kite with three strings, two for wing warping and one for the center, and he actually navigates the kite that way. So this proves to him this theory of wing warping works. Now he's got to build a glider. So he does. He builds one above the bike shop. You know, Orville's not involved at this point. He's just not. But he also, Wilbur does something that will change his life. He writes a letter to a guy named Octave Chanute. Octave Chanute is the leading aeronautical scientist of the time, and he writes him back and says, you know, I approve of your theories. And in fact, this begins a 500-letter correspondence where these two men take on the head-cracking physics of flight, which nobody had done before, because all the numbers will turn out to be wrong that everybody's been working with. But Orville and Octave Chanute are the two guys who are really working in tandem to work this out. Anyway, so he builds his glider. He determines he wants to go to Kitty Hawk, and then he alone goes down to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and almost gets killed in the journey because, you know, if you go down to Kitty Hawk at that time, there's no bridge. You have to go to the Outer Banks. You have to cross the Albemarle Sound. There was a storm. But he is alone at this point. So Orville is really not involved. Now, Orville will come down and join him, okay? But Wilbur will make all the flights all the way up to 1902. And this is something that people don't understand. That Orville, you know, was pretty much acting on Wilbur said, let's do this, let's do that, let's do this. And, you know, so this was his mission. This was his raison d'etre. This was his mission in life to crack flight, not Orville's. If Wilbur had said, you know what, I'm not going to do this flight thing anymore, Orville would have been just fine continuing with the bike business. I mean, he was more of a businessman. Wilbur was not.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. When you were looking at family letters and other archives, are there any things that really stick out in your mind of saying, okay, this shows me that Wilbur was operating on a different level and way more engaged than Orville was?
You know, the family letters and just so, you know, your listeners know, I use the papers of Wilbur and Orville Wright. They're about 2 bound editions, probably a foot and a half tall. And in there are the family letters. Now, the letters that Orville wrote primarily to Catherine and others described a lot of the day-to-day life in the camp in, you know, Kitty Hawk. Okay. Wilbur's letters are all technical, okay? They're mostly the letters that he writes, the big letters are between him and Octave Chanute. And here's where Wilbur does not go to his brother Orville and say, hey, you know, I'm trying to figure this thing out. And you know, and to be fair, Orville would work with him on some problems, okay? But he went primarily to Octave Chanute and the heavy duty, again, working out the math, the physics of flight, because nobody had lift correct. You know, I'm going to segue back to Langley now. Langley did build his big plane. All right, so Langley built his big plane. We had the little steam engine thing he had. He goes down again to the Potomac. All the press is there. A guy named Benchley is going to fly it. And the plane takes off and crashes, just goes like a brick down into the Potomac. Langley is disgraced. And so then he builds a second one, and it does it again. And, you know, and actually it's got to do with Beachley. And Beachley almost drowns, and Langley is disgraced. The Smithsonian is disgraced, and that's in about 1902, 1903. Okay, so really the Smithsonian had a shot, and they lost $50,000 of government mad as hell because their money was wasted on this brick. And so now the only guys that are really close to flying would be Wilbur and Orville. And of course, you know, to the world, they see the Wright brothers, but in fact, this is Wilbur who's moving toward this concept of flight. Because here's the big difference. The big difference was everybody else assumed a plane was like a train, that it went right down a track, that flying was inherently stable. Wilbur said, no, flying is inherently unstable, and you have to compensate. So everybody else was thinking, no, you build a big enough engine, and, you know, and Langley had a 50-horsepower engine, which was huge at the time, and you can fly, okay? So it's just a matter of you point that thing and go. Wilbur was like, no, absolutely not. You know, flight is unstable. And so he had to develop the ailerons. He had to develop the rudder. He had to develop the elevator, you know. So, and there you have the three, triad of control that, in fact, when you go to the patent for the Wright brothers, it's not a patent on an airplane. It's a patent on a method of control. Other men had flown, you know, jumping off the side of buildings or cliffs or whatever, and then they come down, they crash, they only fly through it. Wilbur was the first man to have controlled flight, and that's where he diverged from everyone.
Yeah, you can go back to, I think, the 11th century with a monk who flew a glider off of a bell tower in a monastery. So the idea is there, right. But control is the big one. Orville, he has a fight at some point with the Smithsonian Institute and Glenn Curtiss. Is that after they successfully fly their plane?
Yeah, okay. So and so that factors into Langley. So let's go back to Langley. Okay, Langley's disgraced. Glenn Curtiss is a guy who kind of a ne'er-do-well, but very smart guy. He builds motors for a long time. Then he gets into the flight business, building motors for airplanes. And then he starts to build planes. And he you know, comes up to the Wright brothers and says, hey, I can build, you know, motors for you. And they meet, and they like each other. But here's Curtiss's view on things. Curtiss believed that patents didn't apply. That if you developed an idea, it was like the air. It came from God, and nobody could just patent it. The Wright brothers, you know, worked for years to get their patent on flight, and everybody who flew then had to pay them a royalty because they used their system of control. Well, Curtiss said, that's crazy. There's a thing called a pioneer patent, and that's what the Wright brothers got. Okay. So Wilbur, they get in a big court fight with Curtiss. Wilbur dies. All right. Curtiss figures out, he says, you know what, the only way, I'm going to be bankrupt soon because I can't make planes without paying these guys. The only way I can do is break their patent, their pioneer patent. I'm going to go back and look at Langley's plane and say that plane could fly. So he approaches a guy named Wolcott over at the Smithsonian and says, listen, I'm going to redo the 1903 flyer or the 1896 flyer of Langley, the Langley plane. I think it can fly. I think it was capable of flight. So what does Curtiss do? He makes alterations with current technology. They fly it. The Smithsonian then publishes a report saying, you know what? Our plane was first. Langley, in fact, had a plane that could fly. It was just a pilot error. But, in fact, they were the first ones to build a plane. They publish that. Orville is furious. Okay, he's furious. He said, and the Smithsonian wanted the 1903 flyer. And so Orville says, you know what? I'm sending it over to London, and they're going to exhibit it in the London Museum over there, and I'm not bringing it back until you retract everything you've said and say that I built the first airplane capable of powered flight. And the Smithsonian says, absolutely not. Why? Because they're resurrecting Langley and their reputation from the big fiasco. All right? So he puts them on a steamer, and he ships the 1903 flyer. And for 20 years, it sits over in Britain. Everybody wants it back. FDR, Lindbergh, all these people plead with Orville. Orville's like, no, not until they publish a retraction, basically saying they were wrong, that this whole thing was, you know, something made up by Curtiss, and, you know, and Curtiss made these alterations, and that we had the first plane. It took all the way to 1948 for that plane to finally come back. Orville dies, and in his will is a letter that, because what happens is, and this is where Kelly comes in again, this is where all this stuff dovetails. Kelly is afraid that Orville won't let him publish his book still. So he goes to the Smithsonian and says, look, I'm going to publish all this stuff that's been going on with Smithsonian, and everybody's going to know it. And Smithsonian then says, okay, you know what? Fine, we'll give in. And they give in. And they publish a treatise saying that the Wright brothers were first, and that, in fact, Langley's plane could not fly. Orville dies, but he leaves behind a letter. And in the letter it says, I bequeath the 1903 flyer to the Smithsonian. You can bring it back from Britain. By the way, all through World War II, the flyer was in Britain. They had to take it outside and put it in a town down below ground to protect it because the Germans were bombing the hell out of it. Okay, which, irony upon irony, the very technology that they developed is up above trying to destroy the 1903 flyer. So this letter says, basically, you can have the flyer, but if you ever say anybody ever flew before us, it's going to be yanked out again, and you won't be able to exhibit it. And so in 1948, it finally came back to America. It was shipped away in 28. So for 20 years, the plane that, you know, cracked the Rubicon of flight, that is responsible for human flight, was not in the United States for 20 years.
Okay, so I want to jump back to the moment where they are successful in 1903. Interestingly enough, seem to operate in stealth mode for a number of years, and it seems like they don't become international celebrities till, I think, 1908 in France, when they make a bunch of public demonstrations. So they're in what they would call in Silicon Valley stealth mode for 5 years. Orville, is he still kind of Wilbur's lackey, for a lack of better term, or does his role change, and does this affect the perception?
That's a good question. I mean, they are both. Now, in the great tragedy of the Wright brothers is they had to go right to monetizing their plane. Think about this. They invent this thing. Nobody knows how to monetize it. How do you make money with it? Okay, they stop the whole bicycle shop, they stop all that, and they say, this is how we're going to make our money. So they're kind of more partners in the business part of it, but immediately they have a problem getting a patent. Because, you know, all these other people try to put in patents for flying machines, and, you know, the U.S. Patent Office is like, well, I don't see how this is going to work. And they have to keep getting patent attorneys to try and present a correct patent that the United States will say, you and only you are the ones who invented flight. Add to this the fact that a lot of newspapers didn't cover their flight. And a lot of newspapers just didn't believe them. And every time they had reporters out to Dayton to fly in that cow field, the plane wouldn't fly. So there was a lot, and especially overseas in France, you know, when this Daily Mail article came out, you look at the comments, they all still believe that, you know, Europeans, you know, invented flight first. But in France, there's like a headline, flyers are liars. So you know, they had multiple problems, and they were paranoid. They were super paranoid that other people would catch up to them. Now, Wilbur believed, and rightly so, that the breakthrough he had made because of the technology that he had developed using a wind tunnel and finding the correct coefficients for lift, nobody else had done that, and he was right there. Okay, so he knew it would take him a while to do it. But still, they were super paranoid, and that's why they went into, like you say, stealth mode, where they were keeping it hidden. They're trying to sell it to the government, trying to sell it to the army. The United States was like, oh, we're not that interested in it. And France was more interested in buying it than the United States was, because the government, the United States had been burned with Langley, and they were just like, oh, this isn't going to really work. And so, you know, they were constantly trying to build this plane, a new plane, that would be more stable and they could actually sell. At the same time, they're trying to fight to get a patent. They're trying to make sure that nobody else knows about it. So, yeah, they basically for five years, you know, are basically kind of operating under the radar. And this is making a lot of people go, well, they didn't really fly. You know, how do we know this? This picture, you know, these pictures, what are these? You know, so they were really, you know, rolling the dice in a way, saying, we have this thing and we can make a lot of money on it, but, you know, we can't talk about it. And, you know, there's a lot of people say that was a big mistake, you know, because they basically sort of sat on this secret and slowed down development of airplanes, you know. And yeah, it's a whole nother book. But, basically they kept it a secret. And you're right, until France, when they flew there. And then all these people were like, you know, Wilbur is the guy who flew in France, and he became an international celebrity almost overnight.
Right. I think one of the first reports on flight was in 1903 or 1904 in some journal on beekeeping, gleanings from bee culture.
Right.
This guy from Canada.
Exactly.
I mean, that.
Right.
When was that? It was early on, wasn't it?
It was right after, during the years when they would go and they were flying in that pasture outside of Dayton. So that was probably around 1904, 1905. And here's the crazy thing. The Dayton papers didn't believe them. And they would have people riding streetcars reporting on a plane, a strange object in the air flying in circles around a cow pasture. So then people would go out there to see him. And that bee guy, I forgot his name, Glenning, I think, he went out there and he was amazed. He was like, oh my God. You know, the way he describes it is like seeing a locomotive come toward him in the sky. You know, you think about this. People couldn't believe that somebody could actually go up there and fly around in the air. And to see it was just incredibly amazing. That's why a lot of people just didn't believe him. Even Fred Kelly at that time, who was a journalist, he even wrote later that he didn't believe him. You know. And so, you know, you had this really weird thing happening, you know, in Dayton where you had the Wright brothers flying and proving their plane, people seeing it, but nobody in newspapers officially saying, yeah, they did it. And later, an editor for the Dayton Journal admitted, he said, we just didn't believe it. We just simply didn't believe it.
Well, I'd like to get to the crux of your book on Wilbur's importance over at Orville. So in telling this story, why do you think it's important that people understand that Wilbur designed the first successful plane, not a co-equal partnership between Wilbur and Orville?
Well, you know, and again, I wanted to make these men real. I wanted to take them out. And one of the things I discovered, and interestingly enough, I didn't set out to write a book saying Wilbur Wright invented human flight or invented powered flight. That came as I was doing the research, and I had to call up the publisher and say, you know what, this book is changing. Originally, I was going to write a book more about, you know, what happened in Kitty Hawk, their personal lives and things like that. But then I realized, wait a minute, there's this huge canard in history of saying that these guys were equal, that everything they did was the same, that they were exactly the same, and that they both equally invented this plane. And it simply wasn't true. And part of that is because I'm a writer, and I know that there's really only one author.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's somebody who has a vision, and that vision is the thing that punches through. You know, it's the difference. I just wrote an article for the Smithsonian Magazine that's coming out December 1st. They had me write on the 1903 propeller that they have at the Smithsonian. And it's all, and the article's about the book and my thesis. But I said in that article, I said, it's a difference between a poet and a scribe. You know, the poet has that genius, that inspiration, that thing that people cannot define that makes a number one hit, that makes a book a bestseller, that cracks the code of an invention of the phone or anything that, you know, pushes along humankind. And it's one person that can come up with that. It is not in tandem. It doesn't work that way. And I mean, we as Americans love stories of people that work together because we're a democracy. And, you know, we win the wars by all banding together and teamwork and all that. Team is a big word, big in our lexicon in America. But in fact, when you read the papers of Wilbur and Orville, you find out very quickly that this required somebody who was immensely talented and also had a vision, because you had to take the physics at the time and then take it further. And then you had to take that funny thing of art and twist it, you know, which is where you sort of are able to see why others haven't been able to do this. Because think about this. He's a high school dropout with no formal training at all. He is a bike mechanic. But he had this incredible mind. You know, he had this gift that I would argue that was his destiny, to do this thing. And, you know, and interestingly enough, after he did it, you know, he died soon after, in 1912. So I think, you know, history is a thing where you take the journey and then things present themselves, and history is loaded with mythology a lot of times. And, you know, the right myth was a very powerful myth because it's endured for a long time. You know, these two guys just went and did this. But in fact, that's not really what happened.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, yeah, thank you for sharing this story. And in your research on their lives, was there anything else that you came across that surprised you about the two of them and their Kitty Hawk days or other days that also go against this mythologizing that you talked about?
Yeah, there were so many things, but I think if there's just, you know, one thing that was very surprising to me was, you know, they both had this thing of, they never dated. They never left their home until Orville finally built a mansion. And Catherine never left the home. And when she finally did, when she was in her 50s to marry, Orville would never speak to her again. And Orville had a girlfriend. Her name was Mabel Beck, who was his secretary. And this was revealed in the 1990s by a gentleman who was a kid in the 30s who was going down an alley and looked into Orville's laboratory in Dayton and saw basically Orville and Mabel sitting in a chair making out. And a lot of people suspected it, but this guy didn't talk about this for 60 years. And then he finally did in a newspaper interview. So that was very surprising. But, and you know, you say, well, what's that got to do with the Wright brothers? Well, you know what? They're thinking real people, okay, with human desires. And that was another thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to sort of flesh out these two men and say, no, they were real people. They were humans. They weren't these people who just went and, you know, oh, we're going to invent flight, and then that's it. They had foibles. They had shortcomings. You know, why Wilbur wouldn't, or Orville wouldn't talk to his sister again. It's Freud would have a field day. You know, Catherine took care of them. You know, you think about it. I mean, again, they were a very inbred family in a way. You know, like I said, they basically nobody left the family home.
Yeah, well, that's throwing a lot of nuance into a pretty well-trod story. So, yeah, thank you for sharing all this. And the book is Wright Brothers, Wrong Story, How Wilbur Wright Solved the Problem of Manned Flight. And William, if people would like to find you online, you have a lot of other great books, and you were previously on this podcast to talk about Teddy Roosevelt. Where is the best place to find you online?
Oh, you can go to williamhazelgrove.com. And again, you can put in my name or just put in the name of the book. And, you know, it's pretty much everywhere, so they can find it. But yeah, the site has quite a bit of material on the rights that people can look at.
Great. I'll link to that in the show notes, and people can find out more of what you've been up to there. William, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Out of your day to check out this show. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Fraser, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, Moondoggy from Ohio, and Rick Knowlton. And I'll explain what that means in a second. If you like this show, please like and subscribe on the podcast listener of your choice. Join our Facebook page as well. You can find it if you just search for History Unplugged. And one of the best ways you can help out the show is if you join the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, You also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.